The Future Proof Podcast from News Talk.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland. Hashtag believe in science.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof, the podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. I'm Jonathan McRae. If you'd like to contact us on the show, you can email us, science@newstalk.com. You can find us on Twitter, we're at @NewstalkScience. And we get to all of your comments from last week at the end of the programme. Coming up on this week's show, we're going to be talking about a phenomenon on the internet called Cat Square. Not sure if you've heard of it, but basically people on the internet got together and realised their cats liked sitting inside squares. I don't want to go into it more than that. I'll just leave that sitting there. You'll find out more after we talk through the week's science news with Dr. Shane Bergen from UCD and from DCU, Dr. Susan Kelleher. You're both very welcome. How are we?
Good. How are you?
Good. Excellent. We always skip that bit because it's just, oh, I'm fine. You never think of, like, if you gave me better stuff here, we could have a bit of preamble.
I have a rash, Jonathan, if you'd like to.
Okay.
Okay. That's not, I didn't expect that. Let's awkwardly move to our first story. I'm a rocket ship on my way to Mars on a collision course. I am a satellite. I'm out of control. I'm a sex machine. It's about Chinese rockets. But actually, Susan, do you want to tell us about your rash?
No, I'm okay. I'll just stick with good old fashioned medical advice. Thanks.
Okay, super duper. It's always fun to speculate on friends' medical conditions, I find. But fine, let's talk about the Chinese rocket that's about to crash to Earth this weekend. This is an unusual one, Shane, because things this big, usually when they go up, we want them to stay up.
Yeah, and when they come down, you want them to come down in a controlled way. And there is actually a limit. So objects that are larger than 10 tons in mass, there's a kind of convention that if something is going to fall back to Earth that is that size or heavier, that it should come down in a controlled way so you can make it land in an ocean far away from people, unless you're out there fishing and you're very unlucky. But this weekend, a Chinese rocket called one of the Long March 5B rockets is going to burn up. And part of it is going to re-enter the Earth's atmosphere. And they suspect that only 20 to 40% of it is going to be destroyed upon re-entry due to friction and heat. And the rest of it is going to land somewhere between 30 degrees north and 30 degrees south. So that's kind of as far down as Australia and as far north as the bottom of Spain. So we're okay, which is the main thing. But anyone who's living in those tropical climates, they could be, I suppose, advised to stay indoors. They say that this thing is going to land somewhere in the Pacific Ocean, but the Chinese Space Agency have some bad form in this area. Recently, one of their 5B rockets broke up upon entry and a fragment destroyed some buildings in the Ivory Coast, which is not good. So this object is 13 metres long that's coming back to Earth. So if 20 to 40% of it is broken up, you're still looking at a sizable object. I'm not going to try and do that maths on radio, but it's pretty big.
Do they disintegrate into dust or do they melt or do they get vaporised? Like, I mean, we're talking about large chunks of presumably metal.
It's metal, yeah. And
I can see your eyes searching around trying to think, how am I going to answer this question? You don't know the answer, do you?
No, I can. I'm a physicist. I can speculate widely and sound confident. So what's going to happen is that... so having looked at Apollo 13, I can assure you that what's going to happen is that the metal will skim off the atmosphere as it comes in, and it'll be coming in incredibly quickly. And there'll be a lot of friction as it moves very, very quickly through the atmosphere. As it does so, it gets hotter and hotter, and it will start to break up. As to how it breaks up, whether it vaporizes or whether it just disintegrates, I'm not sure entirely what the disintegration process is, but it is fairly hot. So like the metal will start to deform, it'll melt locally, and bits of it will just start to come off as fractures in the metal are exposed and they rip that way.
Because the way you've described it is how I imagine it, but it still results in, like, you know, probably a kilometer of really fast shrapnel. I mean, I don't understand how this is preferable to just keeping it floating wherever it's floating.
Well, you see, they can't because it's in a low Earth orbit.
But then just don't put something like that in a low Earth orbit.
Well, you know, you're not the only person saying that. And the US government, who really probably can't point fingers in this area, are saying that the Chinese need to have a little bit more space etiquette, and that they're accusing them of negligence. And because this is not the first time it has happened. Of course, the reason I say the US shouldn't be pointing fingers is in March this year, a SpaceX rocket broke up and a fragment of it landed off the coast of Oregon. But that was completely accidental, I believe, and there was no plan. Where with this Chinese rocket, they're saying this was always going to happen because part of the rocket had to fall back, you know?
It's kind of like that scene where Begbie finishes his pint and just throws the glass up in the air without any concern as to where it's going to land. It seems like that sort of,
Isn't that just 20th century technology in a nutshell?
Excellent. Excellent observation. Excellent. Wise, Shane. Wise. Susan, our second story has to do with bees.
Yeah. So this is an interesting one because I think when it comes to COVID and COVID-related research, there's a lot of bandwagon jumping on. So this is an interesting one. So there's a research center called Insect Sense in Wageningen in the Netherlands. And they look into using insects to help detect things like disease biomarkers and VOCs, so volatile organic compounds. And they've taken a crack at using the bees to detect coronavirus. The bees have an exceptional responsive like sense of smell. So we know that bees can find flowers from miles away, but they can detect down to the range of around parts per trillion. This is really hard to get your head around. So I've come up with, I don't know if it's the best analogy, but it's one that I hope will kind of frame it a bit. So if you think about an Olympic sized swimming pool and you think about filling them at rice, now get 40 of them and fill them at rice. And then get someone to put one tiny piece of red rice somewhere in one of them. And then you have to try find it. That's how good bees are at finding one piece of something in a volume of something else. So they're not looking for rice, but they're looking for small molecules that maybe are in the air that we generally would smell. So they're phenomenal at smelling these things. And what this research group did was they exposed the bees to the scent of an infected sample of COVID. And they gave them sugar water when they were introduced to this.
Yeah.
And then by repeating this action, they formed a Pavlovian response in response to finding a positive sample of COVID-19. And eventually, the bees, just upon smelling COVID, stuck their little tongue out to ultimately get the sugar water. But this was then seen as a detection for being able to spot the COVID-19 positive samples. And they can do it within a matter of seconds. And they did this...
Wait, is this new... 5-pack Lidl antigen test for €25. Is that just a bag of 5 bees?
Yes. I would like that. Yeah, and a suit to wear whilst handling the bees. You can also buy there in Lidl if you need it. But it is incredible because you can, this company then is looking to sort of, they've made a prototype because the idea is that obviously bees are very, very common and you can get bees all around the world, but the piece of kit to train the bees is what this company is developing. So they're developing the prototype to be able to roll out in low-income countries where most of the time detection is done on small molecules like this with very expensive lasers or extremely expensive microscopes. And so they're not always attainable. Whereas bees, and hopefully the ability to maybe train them, could be seen as a sort of an accessible way to train these and for other things as well as COVID.
I'm sorry. So if you want to go to a gig, you pass through the turnstile and if you haven't got COVID, you go on in. And if you have got COVID, you're covered in bees. Like what is the application of this technology that is useful to people now?
Well, I mean, I don't know if right now, like, you know, not in Ireland, but certainly as a means to, as an alternative testing, you could imagine it in a lab. So you send off your blood sample and then very quickly, it might not be for the rapid testing, but you send off your blood sample. And then rather than trying to do the assays, which can be difficult and use an awful lot of consumables, then you can do this in a much easier way. It's probably still in a lab or in a company that's running this that knows how to handle the bees and look after the bees, etc. But it's certainly another way of another option, perhaps for situations where money is a little bit tighter or where you have these low income countries that can't sort of run the amplification processes that we would be reliant on here.
I think it's cool that bees can smell COVID. I just find it extremely impossible to imagine that you send off your COVID sample and they go, well, what do the bees say? Bees say you've got COVID.
Like, I think this company obviously is this, you know, they're innovating and they're thinking outside the box. And to be fair, they may not be successful, but, you know, there is a lot to be said for how incredibly sensitive the olfactory senses are of a bee. And perhaps this company is onto something.
Maybe.
I could make a...
I don't think they are, but maybe.
No, okay. But you know what? We'll check back in with them in a few years. Insect sense, in fact, and if anyone's interested.
Okay.
If you were in a place like a busy place, like a school or a college, and you had your bees and the bees gave a signal that there was COVID, it would be a good reason to get people out of that busy room.
I think school rooms need a little less drama these days. Shane, your next story has to do with technology, and it's a bit of relief for us parents who are not very good.
That's what I like that you've seen it that way. It is a good news story. People tend to worry that excessive engagement with technology has effects on young people's mental health. That's something that a lot of people talk about in 2021, but it's something that people have talked about for a long time. When television was introduced, similar things were said. And so this is one perhaps of the most comprehensive studies that I've ever seen that's looked at how technology links to young people's mental health. And incredibly, they've been able to bring together a lot of data to have data representing 430,000 young people in the US and in the UK. And they looked at how they looked at possible associations between social media use and depression, also emotional problems, suicidal thoughts and behavioral problems. And they also looked at those things and how they might associate with television. And so people self-reported how much they engage with their media, be it TV or social media. And they also answered questions that would indicate whether they have depression or emotional behavior. They're crude, but they are well validated in the literature. And perhaps this is surprising to many people, but they have found that there is no change in the association with how much people engage with media, digital media, and their tendency to be depressed or suicidal. So there is overall no increased impact on young people's mental health due to the introduction of social media in the last 10, 12 years. I think, well, firstly, I think that's a little counterintuitive. A lot of people would just say, no, I don't believe that. And when I looked at the comments below the paper, that's what a lot of people were actually saying. But I think this data is important. And perhaps, you know, I think there's a responsibility for the media to report stories like this alongside the more alarming your Twitter is causing your child to be depressed style stories that we tend to see a lot.
It wasn't just social media, right? It was TV as well and other and device use. So, like, you know, there's been this long narrative that using technology, looking at screens is slowly decaying young people's mental health. This is a pretty big study.
It is, absolutely. Yeah. And I would say from the people I know from university that work in mental health is that they say this area is far more complicated than we tend to think it is. And that it is quite normal for parents and for people to fear new things and associate people's mental health with that new thing.
They did it with jazz. They did it with rock and roll. They did it with punk rock, and they did it with heavy metal. Like, this is just like there is this constant social media panic and general media panic about something that's new that wasn't around when you were a kid. I think Douglas Adams had a great definition of technology, didn't he? It's a technology is anything that wasn't around when you were born. And that's all it is. And so there's a tendency for us to fear what we don't know. And it results in, I think, an overstressing and over anxiety when it comes to these things.
But I think it's important also to say that mental health issues are real and they exist. And far, far more should be done to make sure that people who do have mental health issues are, you know, the things are done to help those people. It's just we need to be careful when we throw around accusations as to what might be causing them or to say that they're getting worse.
Susan, our final story has to do with electricity.
I don't know about you guys, but I was a kid who loved lightning. I would run to the window. I would look, stay away from the window. The lightning's coming. I ran there. I had a look out. You know, I was waiting to see this lightning hit the ground, and I still do. And I encourage my own children to do it now as well. And a lot of the research into lightning looks at this type of lightning, this really, you know, powerful, destructive bolt lightning. And it's not a surprise because of the harm that it can do. But actually, only about 10 to 20% of lightning ever leaves the sky, with the rest of it actually forming what's called cloud to cloud or cloud to air lightning. And scientists are becoming increasingly interested in these forms of lightning, and especially how they can affect the atmosphere and things that may be in the atmosphere, like airplanes flying through clouds, etc. So this week, scientists in Penn State have published a paper in Science where they discovered that the lightning in clouds can break down water into two molecules. So the first is the hydroxyl radical, and the second is the hydroperoxyl radical. And this is really important because these two radicals in general, are super reactive, and they're going to bounce into other molecules up there, and they're going to change the chemistry of the atmosphere. And so one thing that they can do is interact with greenhouse gases and start to break them down, which is really interesting from an atmospheric chemistry perspective. And so the experimental setup for this, of course, as a scientist, you're always wondering, how did they discover this? So it was basically flying an airplane through a thunderstorm and measuring the levels of the radicals. And while it's been previously understood that the radicals can be made by the really powerful lightning that we all know and see, this was the first time that it's been reported that these radicals can be made by what's called sub-visible lightning, which is lightning you can't see and is generally hanging around in the sky in between the clouds and coming between the clouds and the air. And like I said, it's just a really fascinating, you know, take on the fact that these molecules will actually change, you know, they'll interact with ozone, they'll interact with methane, they'll interact with other greenhouse gases that are up in the atmosphere and change things depending on levels of storms and the amount of this lightning that's there.
Well, Dr. Shane Bergen from UCD and Dr. Susan Keller from DCU, thanks very much as always. If you're a cat owner, you're probably more than familiar with their proclivity to sit in things. But what is it about boxes and cupboards and squares that compels a cat to get into them? Because as one strange but fascinating study has shown, it's nothing to do with warmth necessarily. Gabriella Smith is Master of Arts in the Animal Behaviour and Conservation Programme at Hunter College, New York. She joins me now. Gabriella, before we start, I mean, it's hard for me to get into stereotypes. I probably shouldn't get into the stereotype, but are you a cat person? Because I'm a dog person. And that's, I don't know if you can be a cat and a dog person, but I don't think, I've never met one. I'm a dog person.
Yeah, I grew up with dogs. And so a couple years ago, I'd probably say I'm a dog person. But since living with a cat in New York City and going to this study, I have become a cat person. I have a cat now. So I think you can be both a dog and a cat person.
So tell us a little bit about some of your work in animal cognition before we talk about these cats.
Yeah, so I've been studying animal cognition since 2016. I started at a octopus cognition lab in southern Italy. I started a project on number comprehension, so numerosity in octopuses. After I graduated from Boston University, I started at the Pepperberg Lab of Avian Cognition at Harvard. She's known for Alex the Gray Parrot, who could functionally vocalize and communicate with humans. Within her lab, I started my master's at Hunter College, and my thesis was on contra freeloading in gray parrots.
What is that?
Contra freeloading is the preference to perform work to access food when there's free food available. So some people think that it's a type of work ethic. Some people think it's a way to learn about one's environment. And it's weird because it contradicts optimal foraging theory, which is the kind of maximization of reward over cost. So you don't want to waste time, you don't want to waste energy in the wild. And so contra freeloading contradicts that because they will perform work to access food when there's free food right there. And so it's interesting to study, to really nail down why they do this. And yeah, the theories that we have out there are that there is a bias when it comes to captivity. The birds in captivity always have access to food. They don't have social competition. They don't have a fear of predation, of being eaten. And so it is likely this optimal foraging theory is thrown out of whack. And so it's likely that contra freeloading is likely a product of captivity. And to me, that is just a light bulb moment of, oh, we should think about captive animals a little bit, you know, more differently, or be more careful with them, because clearly there's effects on their behavior and cognition. So I was interested in studying specifically the Kanitsa illusion, which can be described as four Pac-Men circles with right angles cut inside, and the mouths, we can say, of the Pac-Men are facing inwards. And so we perceive this as a square, even though there are no sides of the square. I had attended a lecture by Sarah Biosier of Hunter College, and she has studied illusions in dogs. And so I was playing with my roommate's cat, and I thought, well, cats will sit in squares, 3D or 2D. So are there illusions that look like squares? So the cats really came first, and then the illusion after.
You said cats tend to sit in squares. Now, before I started reading up on this, I had no idea that this is true. What do you mean cats sit in squares?
Yeah, it's very bizarre. I actually only heard about it through Twitter. So in 2017, this trending hashtag was going around called Cat Square, and people were basically, quote unquote, catching their cats by putting complete shapes on the floor. So complete meaning there's no gaps in the sides. So you could do a circle, you could do a square, you could do a triangle. It really only has to do with the completeness of the shape. And people really don't know why they will sit in it. You know, there are theories as to why they will sit in 3D shapes, such as boxes, but why it translates to something 2D, the jury's still out on that.
So we've actually proven this, that if there's a 2D shape on the floor, a cat will sit in it?
So there, my study actually is the first official study of attraction to 2D shapes on the floor. Prior to that, it's only been anecdotal. And like I said, I heard about it on Twitter.
But so what's really weird to me is there are no 2D shapes in the wild. This is not something that they could have possibly evolved naturally, right?
So it likely derives from their attraction to 3D shapes, which is more easily explained through nature and behavior. The current theories as to why they're attracted to 3D shapes are that it's comforting, that it's, you know, this lateral pressure. Another theory is that they're ambush predators, and so they're attracted to hiding. So it's likely that their very natural, very organic attraction to 3D boxes, caves, you name it, is likely channeled in their attraction to 2D shapes. It's kind of like their brain is tricking them. Could be that.
Yeah, I mean, as a theory, it's not a bad one. But when we think about it, a 2D shape is so different from a 3D physical thing. It's amazing that that you've been able to record this. And so tell me about how you went about performing this experiment to see if cats would sit in these squares. And then we'll talk about the illusion part.
Yeah, so I mean, I did pilot it with a friend's cat and basically had her measure the circumference of her cat's butt and saw what shape they fit into. I started off with the Kanitsa and also a square and the Kanitsa control. So I really started with the illusion and also the square to go ahead, because something important to think about in animal studies is to not prime subjects to kind of the question at hand. So priming meaning, you know, you introduce initial part of the experiment to say, okay, I have a baseline, cats will sit in a square, therefore it is appropriate to translate this to the illusion, for example. I didn't do that because priming them with this initial stage might make them attracted to it and kind of perform how I would want them to. And I wanted them to behave as naturally. So I combined the stimuli simultaneously to really show that there is equal treatment between the illusory square and the real square.
When you say you sized it to the bum of the cat, mm-hmm. Would a cat not sit in a large, roomy circle on the ground? This is such a weird study.
Yeah, it was basically to accommodate for cats of all sorts of sizes. So the square is not, you know, the exact circumference. It was, I think I multiplied it by four to make it large enough. And I also wanted to consider their limbs. And so the criteria for having chosen a stimulus was all limbs inside the contours within 3 seconds. And so there was no sprawling. There was no, you know, one little toe sticking out. I made sure that the bum could be inside and the limbs could be as well.
So ideally, if this thing were true, you'd find the cat sort of squeezed into this imaginary box that came up from the floor in the case of the square.
Yeah, yeah. And future directions we'd like to do is seeing if this illusion can translate into 3D shapes. So something interesting about 2D shapes is that 2D illusions is that they don't really act in the same way as 3D ones because we're given more information as to the 3D ones. And so you can see shadows, you can look behind, and we're probably less likely to fall for them. But, you know, knowing cats and knowing their attraction to boxes, we'd be interested to see if they also fall for it in a 3D scenario.
So once you had this pilot, you were encouraged enough to create a citizen science cat square sort of a project. Tell me what you did and what you got back from people.
Yeah, so I started where I first saw the cat square. I started on Twitter. I got all the ethical approval from Hunter College, designed the study and blasted it out on social media, and the cat people went crazy because you know, citizen science has been largely targeted towards dog owners because they are extremely popular pets. They are easily trained. And cats are, they can be trained, but they are very difficult to train. And as if anyone knows, they're not very motivated to participate unless they choose to. So the cat owners are very excited. I got over 500 signups. But it precipitated over the next couple of days. I had quite a lot of attrition. So a lot of people just left the bandwagon, which is understandable because the study was 6 days long. But every day they were sent stimuli that they printed out and cut out and put on the floor, followed the instructions and watched what their cat did. And they submitted their data and then they received the next day. And so every day for 6 days until at the end, they got a certificate.
So what did you find? Do cats indeed sit in these spaces? Does it matter if it's a circle or a square? And does it matter if it's an illusory square that doesn't actually exist?
So they treat the Kanitsa illusion just like they do a square on the floor. It matters that there are contours in some way, shape, or form. So like I said, they rely on the completeness of a shape. And so the fact that they were susceptible to the illusion means that they were paying attention to the whether or not there were contours or not, illusory or not. With the control of the Pac-Man shapes facing outwards, it doesn't matter that there were four Pac-Man there. It matters that they created contours.
So just to be clear, what you have found is that cats will sit on 2D squares on the ground, but also they will sit on implied 2D squares that are created by a sort of negative space by putting four Pac-Men in a square shape. What does that tell us about the mind of a cat?
That means that, well, it informs us about their visual evolution, that they see boundaries and see their environment very similar to humans. And it's likely that they underwent similar evolutionary pressures in their the development of their vision. And actually, human vision studies began in cats. And their vision is so similar to ours in the sense of perceiving boundaries and contours that anyone who's taken a Neuro 101 course has seen that video of a cat's retina being shown contours, and you can hear their neurons lighting up. So they're very sensitive to contours based on luminance, and that's what the illusion shows.
This is right, that if you look at the activity of a cat's brain while it's shown specific shapes, like a line, for example, it gets quite excited by that idea. Almost like it's, you know, it's a fan of cubist art or something. Those brains get activated in ways that they don't if it's looser shapes. Is that right? Do we know why that would be?
It has more to do with there being a contour rather than they're attracted to a box or attracted to a side. And it's a pretty typical, phenomenon, visuocognitive phenomenon, to be excited by boundaries. And, you know, similar animals like chimps and dogs and sharks and honeybees also are susceptible to the Kinitsa illusion. So it is a pretty widely shared propensity for this type of perception.
Wow. I always, because I've wondered, you must be the perfect person to ask. You know, when you've got a chicken on the ground, mm-hmm. and you draw a line in front of it with its nose to the sand. Have you seen this on the internet?
No.
Oh, so you get it. I've seen this a number of times. I've no idea if it's true, but I thought you might have heard of it. You get a chicken and you hold its beak to the ground, and okay. then you draw a line from its beak away from it.
Uh-huh.
And then if you take up your hand, the chicken won't move. The chicken will stay there as if paralyzed. And then if you leave it there for a while, if you rub off the line, the chicken goes nuts.
What does it do?
It just goes... I mean, what, you know, like a chicken going, it just runs around the place. Like it's very angry with you for getting rid of this line.
I have never heard of that. Well, I have no idea.
Next lockdown, you can check out the chickens and the lines.
Everyone's pet chickens. I will have all the farmers conducting citizen science.
You know, there's not enough chicken science out there. Why study animal cognition? What's important about that, Gabriella?
Theories of cognition are very important to discern how other beings interpret the world. My personal goals, my personal principles are to learn about behavior and cognition in order to better respect and care for these animals, understanding what their environment, how they perceive their environment, and how we can better cater to what they perceive in cases of welfare, in cases of captivity. And so learning how they perceive the world, how in other cases, how it might make them feel, I think are very critical to when they are under our care. So that's what wakes me up in the morning, is learning about how they think and how we can better understand and respect them.
That's really interesting stuff. Gabriella Smith, Master of Arts in the Animal Behavior and Conservation Program at Hunter College. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
So if your cat does this, we would love to hear from you. Or if you have pictures of it trying to squeeze itself into strange places, you can tag us on Twitter. We're at @NewsTalkScience. Last week, we were talking about gene editing and how much better we're getting at it. Dr. Ruth Freeman from Science Foundation Ireland, whose background is in genetics, was blown away by this new development called CRISPR on, CRISPR off, in which you could sort of use a thing that naturally turns off genes, methylation, to turn on the genes you want and turn them off. So you could put methyls on top of these genes, dampening down their activity, or you could remove them. And by doing that, you could make a change to genes and then undo it, which is amazing and would allow for much more experimental types of gene editing to be, I suppose, ethically more feasible, right? Well, we got a text in from Lar in Kilkenny. He says, I just finished Walter Isaacson's excellent The Codebreaker about Professor Jennifer Doudna's work with CRISPR. Surprise is that the scientists think they should define the ethics. Would be like a Porsche engineer deciding on speed limits on the roads. Should the ethics not be worked out by society? I think it's a really good question. I think theoretically, we should all sit down and spend a few hours getting the info, chewing the fat, and have some sort of output, like the Citizens Assembly was intended to do, Lar, I think. Realistically, I think that's not going to happen on a global scale. And as we see, there's fits and starts from universities in different countries and also individual scientists who break the rules a bit. And this will be sort of a lumpy transition, I think, to full-on gene editing. I imagine society will only get a say when something goes horribly wrong. And that's what happened in China. In China, they made new rules to say you can't edit unborn babies because somebody did that. And then they had to make a law saying specifically, do not do that again. So I think ethics ideally should be, we should get a broad representational panel of all of society, young and old, tall and short. But I think realistically, that's just not going to happen. The good news is that I think scientists have dealt with ethics for a long time. They understand the limitations of their own science. And there are ethics boards kind of doing this in a microcosm in every university in the world. So I don't think a Porsche engineer would say, drive however fast you want. This car is perfectly safe. Although they do that in Germany, don't they? The Autobahn, that you can just drive as fast as you want. I think even the Porsche engineer, though, would say, let's not everybody have, drive full speed. That would be crazy. And so I don't know. I think better scientists than just random people, but maybe I have too much faith in science. Let me know your thoughts. You can email us, science@newstalk.com. But that's it from us for this week. Thanks to Aidan McCovey, who was producing, Stephen McLoon, who's on sound, Simon Keane, Garrett Mahal, and Steve Daunt, who round out the excellent team that put this show together. We'll be back with more Future Proof in your podcast feed with an excellent feature with Julia McDowell, who's got her own podcast called Atomic Hobo. You have to check it out. It's about the threat of nuclear war and what Britain did in the run-up to it. We'll be talking about that on Tuesday, but in the meantime, stay curious.